Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by RacePlace.com, RunCatalina.com, the Challenged Athletes Foundation, and you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville Radio on iTunes or Babbittville.com. Our next guest, we're talking one of the greatest Ironman champions in history, a three-time Ironman world champion, Mr. Craig Alexander. Crowey, how the heck are you?
Good, mate. Thanks for having me on again.
No problem. First of all, I thought it was pretty interesting. I was interviewing Meb Keflezighi the other day, who just turned 40, and you're going to turn 42 in next month sometime. How have you had to change things to still be competitive as you've aged?
Yeah, it's a tough process, you know, because I think you do something a certain way for so long, and you get confidence from doing it that way, and you get results doing it that way. So, you know, many people told me I would need to change things as I aged, and I have. I think I do much less now than I used to. And, you know, I don't think I need to do as much because of obviously you're building on a base foundation of fitness that's been, you know, it's been built over 20 years. So I think for me the main thing that changed, particularly the last 18 months to 2 years, was when baby number three came along. I just had less time to train, which fitted in with the new philosophy of doing less, but just less time to recover and less time to do the little things between sessions that I used to do. And, you know, back in the day, training was my main focus every day, and everything would have to be, I guess, scheduled in around that.
Right.
Whereas now the training just gets put in when I can fit it in around you know, other things, business obligations and the kids and other things I've got going on. So as much as the physical changes, I think it's as much a philosophy or a mindset change. It's just not the most important thing in your day, the training anymore. Which is a good thing, You know, for a long time it was my profession and it still is, and I took it very seriously. But, you know, with three children and the oldest being 10, Lucy just turned 10, so... Yeah, things are busy, but busy in a great way.
Well, and speaking of busy in a great way, so now the world-class athlete in the family is Lucy.
Well, just ask her. She'll tell you that.
Come on, old man. Let's go for a run.
Yeah, she's going well. She seems to enjoy it, which is the main thing. She dabbles in a little bit of swimming. She made it through to state this year for swimming, which was good.
And wow.
Yeah, she's a good little athlete, and Great little runner. She won her school cross country in zone, and she's got regional coming up. And I noticed that I think she's got more natural talent than her dad. She doesn't have a dad's work ethic, that's for sure. I took her training last night, and I spied her halfway through the session hiding behind a tree. So,
she
seems to really. I think she enjoys the competitive aspect of it. She loves to race more than she likes to train. So
yeah.
It's interesting and fun to watch.
So what I wanted to do tonight, if that's okay, is when I look back at your career, it's like there's signature moments starting in, obviously, before 2005. You'd won Chicago, U.S. Pro Champs in Boston. You'd won so many different things. But I look at the big breakthrough race was Lifetime Fitness 2005, just because of the big prize purse, and it also put you in a position to travel with the family, which, you know, you're a family guy, and being able to be with the family seemed to give you a comfort level that allowed you to be successful.
Yeah, I think that was an important race financially, but also as an athlete, it validated what I was doing. And, you know, I'd raced a lot of those guys, but to beat, you know, the best in the world on the same day, wow, on an occasion that, you know, everybody's training for, it was my mini Olympics. It was, you know, I sort of started coming to the US in 2002, left the ITU style of racing, and never really did that many in my whole career anyway. And so the guys I'd sort of come through with, you know, the Bevan Dockertys and Simon Whitfield, I rarely got to race except at Minnesota each year.
Right.
And it was just an important breakthrough mentally from that aspect, but also from the point of view that Lucy had just been born. And, you know, in the past when I'd structured a season, I'd always put 10 or 15 races in the schedule. And to me, they would all carry equal importance. I think I learned a big lesson that year, and it was, I guess, by accident, really, because Lucy was born early in the year. I didn't get to come over and race St. Anthony's and St. Croix and all the ones that I used to do early in the season. And I had to be a lot more selective with the racing. So we didn't get to the US until mid-June. And I just really put all my eggs in the Minnesota basket. That was it. And so I think the penalty finally dropped it. That's the way you're meant to do it. Rather than hedging your bets, you're meant to pick the races that are important to you and actually have the confidence and the belief to prepare for them the right way and not be daunted by embrace that challenge. You know, I didn't feel extra pressure knowing that Minnesota was really my only big race of the year. I actually embraced it and took it on. And afterwards, you know, in the debrief, I thought, well, that's really how you're meant to race. I'm sure that's how Mark and Dave used to do it back in the day, and Lessing and Welshie. They would pick the major races and really focus on those. And in the past, as you mentioned, I'd do St. Anthony's, I'd do St. Croix, I'd do Chicago, LA, the US Pro Champs, and they're all equally important to me. But I think sometimes when you do that inadvertently, it almost undermines mentally your ability to step up on one day and win, because you know there's always a last chance saloon down the road somewhere. Whereas that year there was nothing else but Minnesota for me. And yeah, I think it was an important shift in my sort of mental approach moving forward.
Yeah, it takes a lot of confidence to do that, because it's sort of, if you're sitting in third or fourth place, you go, hey, I'm racing again next week, I think I'll back it off a little bit. You sort of just get into the mode of, hey, I'm racing all the time. So all of these, if I have a great day or somebody doesn't show up, I'm going to do well. But otherwise, I'll think about next week.
Yeah, and I think that's human nature. I think, you know, when the pressure's on in the race and it gets hard, you know, all of us as athletes, whatever level, you can have doubts and your mind can wander for sure. And I think it gives you a certain focus and a certain drive when you realize there is nothing else. This is it. It definitely makes your focus more acute and a lot sharper, and I think gives you the ability to get a few extra percent out of yourself.
So then when I look at the major race for 2006, it's, you know, 70.3 Worlds, right? And that winning the first one down in Clearwater gave you the golden ticket to go to Kona.
Yeah, I think it was important for a number of reasons. Obviously, the qualification to Kona was huge.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I hadn't been beaten in a half Ironman or a 70.3 race for several years, but there was no actually official sanctioned world championship.
Exactly. And it wasn't really, up until then, it wasn't really a 70.3 world championship. It was just a bunch of half Ironman events.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that was the first year there was actually a credible circuit culminating in an officially sanctioned world championship. So, yeah, I set my sights on that. It was also, you know, I raced for Try Dubai that year. I got invited to race in that team, which was, you know, it was purely a long course team. I was the only short course guy on the team, but through that team I got to meet Peter and Norman and Tim and, you know, the superstars of triathlon. Yeah, absolutely, and that really whet my appetite. It was a huge opportunity for me to be invited to be a part of that team, and I felt a lot of pressure to perform, to live up to the results that the other guys were getting, and fortunately, I had a great season. I was able to win Chicago for the second time that year, and St. Croix,
yep,
I think, for the third or fourth time. And then, yeah, obviously the big one was 70.3 Worlds in Clearwater, which punched my ticket through to Kona the following year.
So what did you learn from – were there some camps where you would train with Peter and Tim and Norman? And what did you learn from those guys?
You know, they had camps. I got on the team too late to attend any of the camps, but – you know, there was a lot of banter on the email. I remember when I was introduced to my fellow teammates. I just signed with the team, and I was introduced. I got an email. An email came back from Norman saying, "Great, another wheel sucker on the team."
That is great. Welcome.
Yeah,
so, welcome.
Yeah, welcome.
Welcome, idiot.
Welcome.
Yeah,
but,
that's great.
Yeah,
that is,
no,
so
it was
Norman.
Awesome.
That, I love that.
They made me feel completely welcome, and it also... yeah, being, I guess, on the shy side, it gave me the opportunity through the team to chat to these guys, and you know, it was a massive opportunity. And then that year, I mean, obviously Norman went on to win Kona. I think our team had three on the podium at Kona and another three. I know I got the gold and Lessing got the silver in Clearwater, and I think Lisa Bentley was on the podium at 70.3 Worlds that year as well. So it was just a fantastic thing to be a part of and become friends with these guys and get to chat to them and have the opportunity to, I wouldn't say pick their brain, but it was just a nice opportunity to be able to rub shoulders with them.
A lot of people, when you mention the name Simon Lessing, I mean, you and I both are like, oh, my God, one of the most talented guys in the history of the sport and, you know, a five-time world champion. But because he didn't have the performances that he probably should have at the Olympics, people don't really know much about him. Was he somebody you raced fairly often?
Particularly when I came to the U.S., yes. I mean, he's the best athlete I've ever raced. I think if you spoke to a lot of athletes who raced through the 90s and the 2000s, they would say the same thing. Just, you know, everyone looks at Alistair and Jonathan Brownlee now. Well, he was that back in the 90s. I don't think he lost an ITU race for 7 or 8 years. He didn't win the Olympics, and I think it was by virtue of the fact he was such an overwhelming force and such a dominant force that there was almost this mindset within the race that the rest of the field almost galvanized themselves together to not let him win.
Right.
You know, anyone but him was almost the mentality. And I think that's what you see in that style of racing when someone's so dominant. And that's certainly what Gwen's going to face in the lead-up to Rio. She has won so much and is so dominant. You know, the whole field is almost praying for somebody else to win or wanting somebody else to win. And, Simon, he was just a complete athlete. And, you know, he came to the U.S. He had been racing in the U.S. his whole career, but he sort of finished with his ITU career in 2002. He raced the Commonwealth Games.
Yeah.
He represented England. And then, obviously, he had married Lisa, and they moved to Boulder. And that was 2002, and that was the year I came to the U.S. the first time and really got to race him the first time properly, I would say, at L.A. that year in one of the best fields I've ever raced in the U.S.
That was, everybody was there, right? Craig Walton, everybody was there.
Everybody. It was, I think it had three or four ITU world champions in the field, Olivier Marceau, Van Leet. It was an unbelievable field. And, Simon, he was just a complete athlete. He could win the race by getting in a break in the swim. He could attack off the front on the bike, and he was usually the best runner in the field. So he didn't have any weaknesses. He was mentally very tough. And I think the mark of a great athlete is their level of consistency. I cannot remember when he had a bad race. Maybe late in his career when he was battling a few injuries, he had problems with his stomach and also his lower back and hamstrings, which I can relate to. But for 15 years, he did not finish off a podium anywhere in any style of race, short course, long course, drafting, non-drafting. Just a phenomenal athlete and a guy I got to know very well. He lives in Boulder and we were spending the summers there, and talk about having some talented offspring as well. His two girls are unbelievable athletes. His eldest daughter, Emily, is quite the swimmer.
Ah, interesting. So he's going to have some, probably move in the triathlon at some point.
Yeah, perhaps. I think some of the talent scouts are actually earmarking her as a potential world-class swimmer. She's that good. So he's a good guy, Simon. I'd heard a lot of rumors about him before I actually met him, but I found him nothing but generous, just a gentleman, an honest guy.
Yep.
Would never be a. She was always completely honest, and I always liked and appreciated that, and I always got on really well with him.
So you move on to 2007, second in Kona, first time out, had, you know, great race. Usually takes people a long time to figure out Kona, but you had done your homework and were ready for that race. It was one of those races that I'm sure you wanted to win, but coming away with second, first time out, you had to be happy with that.
Yeah, no, that was like a win for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I was so respectful of the race and the history of the race, and I knew that the names that have gone before me and had troubles there. And, I think when you race, particularly a race like Kona for the first time, it's very hard to push deep into the world, to those levels, because you've never raced there, and there's so many stories of people ending up just sitting in the gutter halfway into the marathon, and you don't want to add your name to that list.
No.
And I think it's very smart to err on the side of being conservative, and I was very conservative, and you have to be your first time, I felt. I mean, you know, obviously I didn't go into that race thinking I'm going to win this race, but I certainly was on the start line thinking, I'm a very good chance to perform well today. I've done a great build-up. I've sought as much advice as I could from people who have raced here and done well here. I've been performing well at 70.3 races. I think I'd won 9 of the 11 races I'd done that year leading into Kona, so I was full of confidence. I thought I had some good form and good momentum. But it's a different race. I mean, when you've watched a race on television and dreamt about racing in a race, and then you are actually in the race, there's almost an element of... I found it a very enjoyable race, to be honest. I didn't feel any pressure. I was just unbelievably excited to be there. I loved being there, and it was like Christmas Day. That was the race I'd always wanted to do, and I was finally there. And I do remember the excitement factor certainly outweighing the anxiety or the nervousness. And that came later as more pressure, I guess, was heaped upon myself leading into the race. But that first experience was incredible.
When you come away from, basically taking second by just a couple minutes, and now you're starting to think about the following year. How did you change much between 2007, 2008?
I did change quite a bit. I learned a lot from that race that you can only learn by doing it. Things that I could incorporate into my training that I hadn't done, and just how to attack the race.
Yeah.
You can do all your training rides on the course you want and your simulated race brick sessions, but to actually go out there and race in those conditions for that length of time, you learn so much. So I did learn a lot about how I could attack the race, how deep I could go, a lot about myself as an athlete and how important the mental side of it was, how important it was to be stress-free and relaxed going in. But I did change quite a bit in the training and, I certainly didn't go back in 08 thinking, well, now that I've got second, I'm automatically going to win. But I went back thinking, I definitely feel I'm a much better Ironman triathlete than I was this time 12 months ago.
And so when you win the race, that changes everything in terms of your perception of yourself, other people's perception, sponsors, more commitments. Defending is tough, right? Because now you're sort of the mark guy. How the change between 2008 and 2009, coming back as a defending champion, what type of pressure did you feel or did you feel any at all?
No, I felt a lot. I put a lot on myself because, it was one of the first questions I got asked in the post-race press conference in OA was how was I going to defend? It was rarely done. So I was put on notice straight away.
Yeah.
And obviously only Dave, Mark, and Tim had done it.
Right.
So I put a lot of pressure on myself because I wanted to be the next one. I wanted to add my name to that list. And I think the toughest years I've had were 2009 and 2012 when I came back as defending champions. Maybe 2012 even more so because you just got more sponsors, more
obligations,
More obligations, more demands on your time. And also from a personal standpoint, I think, I wanted to defend again in 12 as well. I put that pressure on myself. So, I did make some mistakes in 09. I felt the need to train exactly the same way I had the year before because I had a race in 08 where I think I beat Aniko by 3.5 minutes and I thought I had another few minutes up my sleeve. I had one of those rare days where I felt I was just a little bit below where I could have been. I was keeping it controlled and you dream about those days and you want every day to feel like that, to know that you've got an extra gear or two if you need it. So I felt a lot of pressure to replicate every little thing, travel days, training sessions, and that was probably a mistake. There's more than one way to do it. Being self-coached, I've always said I think it was an advantage, but it also had its disadvantages because, whilst I was getting as much advice as I could on a day-to-day basis, not having that sort of unemotional extra opinion that you could lean on probably did weigh me down a little bit and was a disadvantage in 09 because, as I said, I just tried to replicate everything from 12 months before to the point where I did overtrain and I got heat stroke in Kona 3 weeks before the race.
Really?
I was just run down from... I'd raced Muskoka the weekend before, which was always my tune-up race, and had travelled from there back to Kona, packed up our condo with Neri, and then we flew out to Kona on the Tuesday, so I'd had 2 nights with very little sleep on the back of a race. And then, of course, you get out to Kona, and it's hot and humid, and you know, I was very fit. I was chock full of red blood cells from being up in
up at altitude,
up in Colorado. But I hadn't acclimated to the heat and humidity. And those first couple of days there, I just, as I said, I felt a pressure to replicate the sessions that I'd done on those days the year before, and just pushed too hard and ended up fainting at the end of a bike ride. And
wow.
Yeah, I was very overtrained. Fortunately, I had enough time to recover, and but it was a lesson, and that was the red flag that I was fit. And when I look back at 2009, I think my best race of the season was that race in Muskoka 4 weeks out. I think I ran a 1:10 or a 1:11 on a very hilly.
Yeah,
so I had great fitness and I had no need to panic, but I think that's just the pressure that comes with being a defending champion in that race.
So, but the way you talk about it, it's like, you know, everything went, you still won.
I did, and that is one of my... I think that was a testament to more mental toughness than physical prowess that day. I remember Mark Allen saying to me that, you know, when you've won the race, the fact that the other athletes know that you've won gives you some currency to spend during the race.
It does.
They expect you to perform at a certain level. And I think I lent on that fact a lot in that race in 2009. In the bike ride, I didn't feel very good. I had some problems with my back and my bike position that year. I struggled on the bike, but I thought if I can just stay in this front group, the longer the race goes on, that currency of the other athletes knowing that I'm the defending champion and knowing that I can close the deal here, hopefully, will bring me a little respite later on. And I'm not sure if it was that or if I just I came good, but I swam well that year, and I struggled the whole bike ride, but I still managed to come off with Raylert and Rasmus Henning and Dirk Bockel and the major contenders. Obviously, Lieto was up the road, as was Marino and a few of the other boys. But I felt my main competition, I was right.
You were with the guys. And, yeah, you were with Raylert.
Yeah, right where I needed to be. Notwithstanding Lieto, who I figured was my main competition as well that year, having had raced him earlier in the season. But, you know, it's kind of like when you race people, you know, in boxing they say styles make fights. I think it's the same in triathlon. You know, I was very confident racing people who had a similar style to me, which is swim in the front group, bike in the front group, and then run, try and win it with the marathon. Lieto had a different style to a lot of the guys. He would swim in the front group and then bike off the front like Norman.
Yes.
And so, you know, you always wonder how much time you can give up, how his running's coming along. And as I said, I'd raced him twice earlier that season, and he'd performed at a level I hadn't seen him race at before. He was killing it. He was going really well. And so that was an uncomfortable race all round, 2009, but one of my fondest memories, because mentally I stuck with it all day, and I really dug deep, and, I was able to come away with the win. I don't think it was pretty. I think that's the slowest marathon I ever ran there to win the race. But, you know, it's not really about times. It's more about the conditions and the competition, and it was a very... for me, it was a very proud victory.
Well, it's interesting. I remember talking to Lieto, because you guys had some, was it up in Boise? I forget where it was.
Yep.
Where he had a lead, a good-sized lead, and he told the cyclist, hey, just let me know, lead cyclist, hey, just let me know if somebody's coming. And he kept saying, anybody coming? No. And then the guy goes, oh, crap. And he goes, what do you mean, oh, crap? There's somebody right there. It was like, he goes, thanks for letting me know. All of a sudden, here you come. It was like, wasn't it like a sprint finish? You got him?
Yeah, you know, that we had a rivalry for a couple of years there.
Yes.
I think we both pushed each other to sort of great heights in racing. There was, Boise was a sprint finish.
Yeah.
We raced, the first race we did was Honu the week before, where he blew past me on the bike and got a 7-minute lead. And, you know, I got off the bike, I think, with Luke McKenzie and a few other really good bikers, but Chris had just destroyed us. And I didn't think I'd catch him, but I ended up catching him. And I think I ran 8 minutes out of him that day to win the race. And I thought, this guy is going to be a danger in Kona.
Yeah.
And I knew he was racing Boise the following weekend, so I jumped in and entered.
Oh, so you weren't planning?
I wasn't planning on racing, but I thought I need to race him again. I need to learn more about him. I need to race him again. And the funny thing is, the next week he raced completely differently. I actually had a little lead on him out of the water, and he didn't catch me until later in the bike.
Yeah.
And then he only had, I think from memory, it was 3 minutes on me off the bike. The week before he'd had seven, and then this week I think it was like 2.5 or 3 minutes, and I thought, wow, I ran 8 minutes out of him last week. This is in the bag. And I did not catch him until the very last step of the run.
Wow.
And he had, I think, the second quickest run of the day that day. He outran guys like Joe Gambles and quality athletes. And
yes.
I just thought, wow, this is a guy who knows himself very well, knows how to race differently in different conditions. And then obviously, fast forward a few months, we had a battle in...
You had a big battle
in Kona.
Yeah.
And then another one in Las Vegas a few years later where I had to outrun him to win the 70.3 Worlds a few years after that.
Oh, in 2011.
Yeah, so he rode amazing on that tough course. I think he rode a 205 that day as well. So, yeah, he was certainly a guy who pushed me to great lengths and made me improve. When I knew he was in a race, I thought, well, I'm going to have to ride as well as I can ride and then run very well off a hard bike ride. So he made me certainly aware. When he was in the races, I was always on high notice.
I remember there was a period there where he was up in Mammoth training with Bob Larson and Meb and that whole group. And I think that though that was that era when he was running really well before he had more foot problems. So 2010, you mentioned with Lessing, sort of at the Olympics, anybody but Lessing. And I think it became in 2010, ABC, anybody but Crowley. Right? It started with Macca going, hey, Norman, Timo, Ferris, we've got to gang up and attack Crowley or else he's going to beat us again. And that sort of is what happened, right? Those guys between Kauai High, Javi, and Kauai High attacked.
Yeah.
And they put, 7.5 minutes
by the time they got off the bike. They did it well. They did it really well. I think it was, as you said, Chris had been talking about it all year.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, I haven't read his book, but people tell me he documents in his book how he went to Marino and went to a few guys in Europe, and they did it well. They did it well. I knew about it. I thought it wouldn't matter. I'd run a 2:40 and win the race anyway. And I ran a 2:41, but didn't win. So
you ran 2:41, and I mean, you had a great run, right?
But I had a great race. I think you got to give those guys credit. I mean, And that's where, you look at Mark's domination and Paula's and Natasha's and people were able to win year after year. The whole field's conspiring against them, and yet they were still able to do it. I think speaks volumes for just how good they were. 2010 was disappointing that I didn't win, but it certainly wasn't disappointing from a race performance standpoint. I thought I'd raced well.
You did race well. Your times were right there. The thing that that sticks out... The things that sticks out, obviously, is the, 7.5 minutes or so difference in the bike splits between you and Macca there.
Yeah.
But what it shows, you remember when Paula lost in 95, and she had one way of racing. She went off the front. And that was what had worked for her. And what had worked for you was your style. So, but for 96, she was like, I'm not going off the front. I'm going to mix it up with the girls. And if I win, I win. If I don't, I don't. But I don't care. And she says, that's probably why I won. So you come back in 2011, and what a champion does, the champion adapts. So you look at your bike split from 2010 to 2011, I think you're like 15 minutes faster from 2010 to 2011, wearing the Aero helmet, which you hadn't worn before. So you changed. And when you came, was that something immediate after that race in 2010? Okay, my formula worked, but now I need a new formula.
Yes, immediately after. I wouldn't say immediately, but probably within 2 weeks after the race in 2010. I was at home in Sydney, and a good friend who'd always been a mentor came around. He rang me, actually. He said, I'm in Australia, can I come around? He came around and he said, what are your plans for next year? You're 37 now, and are you thinking about racing? And I said, yeah, I am. I am thinking about racing. And he said, I think you should. And he said, you can see, you can look at the race this year any way you want, but how you should look at it is an opportunity to maybe broaden your horizons a little bit. And he knew that it had bugged me a little bit that, I thought I was, when I went to Kona, I was racing the right way, and the way Mark had won six, which is do what you have to do and then win it with the marathon. And, I copped a little bit of criticism for that in certain quarters, which shouldn't have bugged me, but it did. You're only human.
Right.
And this friend said, this gives you the opportunity to change things up and do what you've always wanted to do anyway. So why don't you overhaul everything? And he said, the aero helmet thing is something you can look at, and a whole lot of things. And so I did make a lot of changes with equipment, with my training, but also more my mindset. Rather than just going to Kona and trying to swim in the front five or ten, and then trying to sit with who I considered to be the best runners,
yes,
and get off the bike with them, you know, I had the mindset of, if any brakes go on the bike, I'm going to try and go with them. I'm not going to be reactive. I'm going to be proactive and try and get up the road and just see what happens. And I knew I was riding well. I'd won the 70.3 Worlds in Vegas, yep, a month before, and I'd had a flat tire in that race. I was able to come back from that and still get off the bike second behind Liedo and run a 1:11 and win the race. I felt my form was very good. I felt swimming, biking and running, I was as good as I could have been, and I was determined to be very attentive at the front of the bike, and that's what I did. I sat in the first two or three all through town as we headed out of town, and we got to the airport and the first move went, and I think it was Liedo, surprise,
yeah,
surprise.
Yeah.
And, you know, Marino went with him, and I thought, I'm going too. So I did, and Luke McKenzie came with me, and we got across. I didn't look back for about 10 miles, but when I looked back, we had a gap.
Yeah.
And I felt completely comfortable. So I said, this is my ticket right here. And, got up to Harvey, and I felt so controlled that day. I felt amazing. It was one of those races where I was really in the moment enjoying it, because that's how you dream about feeling in a race, feeling
right,
that good. But sometimes with that, there's a danger too, that you get complacent. And so I was paying attention to the race and the things I had to do, but I was really enjoying the race. And, you know, coming down from Harvey, I got on the front a lot. I wanted to get on the front of that group and, you know, put a little bit of a mark on the race. And I remember we got back, I think we got to about 90 miles, Waikalara on the way back, and I was sitting second, Liedo was leading, and he started riding off the front, and I felt so comfortable that I actually contemplated going with him. That's how good I was feeling.
You're like, and, wait a second, I don't think I need to do that.
No, except, well, I did. For the first couple of miles, I did. I went with him and opened up a little gap on the others, and I thought, well, this is crazy, you know. That was the year Marino had broken the world record in Austria, and he'd
right,
run a 2:39. So
yes,
I thought, well, hang on, that's, you know, you need to be sensible. And I knew Luke had improved his running a lot, so I thought, and then we had Ray Lert just 5 or 6 minutes back. He'd broken the world record in
yes,
Ross that year as
yeah,
well,
yeah,
and with just an unbelievable race, still one of the all-time, if not the best Ironman distance performance ever. So, I checked myself, and I think Chris rode 2 or 3 minutes out of us in the last 40 kilometres, but just got off the bike feeling fresh. The freshest I've ever felt getting off the bike in an Ironman was that day. And, yeah, I didn't notice the heat. It was a very hot day. I didn't notice anything. Just felt great and wanted to push. I knew Andy would be chasing hard from behind, as would a few other guys. So, and I had a plan for the marathon, and I will say I stuck to it for the most part, until Andy really put a lot of pressure on me in the middle and I changed my plan a little bit, which came back to bite me late, but it was a great race. It was just, that was probably my fondest memory in Kona, just being locked in that duel with Andy in the marathon and then Pete later in the marathon, and just coming back and racing that way. It was a very satisfying race.
Well, especially when you, again, when you go 15 minutes faster on a bike, and some of that's conditions, but obviously you were cycling. You were cycling with the lead group.
Yep.
You changed perceptions of how you do the race. So, and you broke the record. So you become the first guy to win 70.3 in Kona the same year. You go 8:03 and break the course record. So when you walk away from that race, when you basically changed and succeeded, at that, and you're also, you know what, 38 at that point, right? 38.
Yeah.
So you're the oldest guy to win the race. At that point, did you think, okay, I got three, I got the world championships, I got the world championship, now's a good time to walk, do a Mark Allen, and go into the sunset?
No, I can honestly say I didn't think that. A few people suggested it to
yeah,
me would be a nice way to leave, but I just love the sport.
Yeah.
I love racing, and as you mentioned, I'd had a great season, I'd had a great race. I'd won 2 world titles in a month, which rarely happens. I was, you know, And straight away, the race in Melbourne got put on my radar. It was a new race. I mean, that was the year they restructured the racing a little bit. And rather than just having one big race a year, which was Kona, they were having the regional championships, which was, I guess, was a way of trying to attract good fields at events outside of Kona, because you rarely saw that. You know, you'd see all the best people racing Kona, but I think with the advent of the regional championships, we actually saw better fields getting together to race. And, you know, we were having one in Melbourne 6 months later. So, you know, I put that on my radar. I was very excited to do that, and I didn't consider walking away. I was really enjoying the sport and my training as much as I had at any point in my career. And, you know, we still had a young family. Neri was still as supportive as ever, and, you know, we got home and had the usual chat, and she said, yeah, let's keep going. And I wanted to. She could say I wanted to. She said, absolutely, let's keep going. And, you know, fast forward, I didn't race. I was very, very busy, obviously, as you are, coming off a victory in Kona and a couple of world titles. I signed some great new sponsors. I had a lot of travelling, and I didn't get to race again until Melbourne, which was 6 months later. So that was the first time in my career I had done two Ironmans as consecutive races. I'd never done that. And, you know, looking back, it was tough at my age, you know, obviously with the rule changes, which I've been on the record of saying I was never a fan of WTC changing the rules.
No.
And that was a selfish opinion on my part because I was an older athlete. And it was hard to prepare for two races. You know, and I guess the counter to the argument is I could have picked a lower profile race than Melbourne to do, or I could have just validated as such. But
I wanted to race. Well, that's not
Absolutely. I wanted to race. I wanted to race, particularly Melbourne. You know, you rarely get to race an Ironman in your home country as the defending world champion, the reigning world champion, and I wanted to do that in Melbourne, a city that loves sports, and it was putting on a great race in it. I was motivated to do it. So, but it was another, just like Kona had been 6 months before, it was a deep effort. You know, I had Llanos and Van Leerd and Brown and Bart Arnauts and Luke McKenzie. It was just an unbelievable field. Marco Albert. It was just, and I had to go deep again. And, you know, looking back in hindsight, you know, that race in Melbourne, I think I had to ride 4:23 and then I ran a 2:38. And I remember laying in bed about 10 days after that race, still aching. That was the first time I really felt my age in the sport. In my head, I was always 25, whatever age I was. Even going into 2011, when people saying no one your age has ever won, I felt 25. But 2012, the aches and pains started appearing. And that race in Melbourne was so tough. I mean, obviously, Brownie pushed me the whole way. The run's on this concrete path. It's quite undulating in the second half. And I had to dig as deep as I've dug at any point in my career to hold him off that day. And it hurt me. My recovery from that race was longer than any other race I've done. So I took some more time off, and it was just a busy year. I mentioned to you before that 2012 and 2009 were potentially the toughest years in terms of pressure and obligations, and that was also the year we decided, 12 was the year we decided to do the photo book.
Right.
So actually, the photographer had followed me in 2011, but once we'd, you know, the photos, the 12-month period of the photographs culminated with Melbourne. And then after that, we had to...
do the copy. The text. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We had to do the text and then promote the book.
Right.
It was very busy.
Yeah, the timing is... That stuff takes a lot of time, but you've got it. When the book comes out is when you got to strike while the iron's hot. You're Ironman World Champion, Melbourne Champion, and now's the time to get the book out and promote it.
Absolutely. And it's a lot of work, and, you know, you have a massive responsibility and obligation to the people who have made the book to live up to your end of the agreement, which is promote the thing.
And, exactly.
And we tried to do that to the best we could, but it took a lot of time. It was a very busy, very busy year, very, very stressful year. I don't think Neri and I have ever argued more than we did that year. It was just tough trying to hold things together, you know. Neri was pregnant with our third baby. We had the two others. She was carrying a huge load. I was home probably the least amount of time I've ever been, just travelling to promote the book and still trying to race. And on the racing front, things were going okay. I raced in Eagleman and had a good win out there. And was still able to get a silver medal in Vegas that year, but for me, the writing was on the wall. July, August, I was having troubles with my body, with illness, and I was having trouble keeping the whole thing together. And I think emotionally, it had taken a toll, and I look at that silver medal in Vegas that year as a miracle. I don't know how I got on the podium and pulled that race out, because I really had no right to do it. And, you know, fast track another 6 weeks to, or 5 weeks, I think it was, to Kona.
You were toast.
Yeah, I was nowhere where I needed to be.
But you still were 12th. Nothing wrong with that.
I had an honourable 12th place. I didn't quit. I was well beaten by the boys up the front, and they delivered a performance that you need to win, and I was well short of that. But I did the best I could, which I'm proud of. But, yeah, I look back, and just emotionally and physically, it was a tough last 6 months to the year. And as you mentioned, you know, when the opportunities come along to sign certain sponsors and to do a book, it's all time-related. I'd come off a great season the year before, and that was the opportunity to strike. So that's what we did, and I have no regrets looking back. I'm very proud of the book we did, and it's just... It was a busy year.
Exactly. What I was going to say is, I remember, you know, interviewing Alberto Salazar years ago, and, you know, he started off his year, because this is 84, and he was thinking of doubling in the 10,000 in the marathon. So during that summer, you know, he beat Henry Rono, he lost to Henry Rono in a 10K the week before Boston, right? And he ran like 27 mid, then he wins Boston, then he breaks American world record for 5,000, 10,000 that summer, then he bookends that with winning New York City. So within 6 months, he basically had four or five world-class performances. Craig Alexander wins 70.3 in Vegas, a month later wins Kona, and then a month later goes, you know, 50-33, 4:24:42, and, you know, runs 2:38:45 to not just go 7:57, but Cam Brown is freaking going 8 hours and 12 seconds and runs 2:41 off the bike. So you had to go that hard. So you had three world-class performances in the span of 6 months at the age of 38. So that, you know, you bury yourself, right? There's only that many, you know, bullets in the chamber. And you wonder if, you know, as a world-class athlete, when you have break the world record and have three world-class performances 6 months, as a guy who studies human bodies, you know, your background, you probably knew, okay, I think I might have done it here.
Yeah, well, I knew there would be a tipping point for sure, but I was just always pushing the envelope, pushing. That was the way I just went about it. And I mean, I tried to put the age thing out of my head completely, and I got asked about it a lot, as you do. I think when you get to your mid-30s, the retirement question is a relevant one, because how long can you keep going? And I think what we've seen in all sports, not just our sport, is people compete later into life at a very high level because of, you know, I guess the knowledge around all sports is improving, the science of recovery, nutrition, all those things is enabling athletes to push on later in life. But there is going to be a tipping point for sure. And, you know, I look enviously at guys like Sebi now and Fredino, and they can just race hard every single time out. And I remember those days, you know. seems like a long time ago. But, yeah, there'll be a tipping point. I can honestly say, though, I look back with no regrets. I mean, it was said to me often after Melbourne that I shouldn't have pushed that deep. I should have just validated, and I guess that's a legitimate argument. But I wanted to win an Asia Pacific Championship in my home country. You know, extra incentive was the trophy was named after one of my idols, Greg Welsh. It was, you know, they named the trophies in Melbourne after Greg and McKeely. You know, triathlon royalty in our country, and I wanted to be the first name on Greg's trophy, so I had a lot of motivation to race well in Melbourne, and I was never going down there just to validate. So, you know, you make these decisions, and I don't look back and regret any of it. I will say, you know, I knew at some point there would be a tipping point where my body wouldn't recover and respond to the training the way it once had, and I think that's just inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that I like the fact that if you're an Ironman world champion, you could just go to Kona and not have to worry about, quote-unquote, validating. You validated by winning Kona. I think that's plenty of validation. I want the champions there. I want Tim DeBoom to know that tomorrow, that if he feels like coming over, that we want him there. And this the same for someone like yourself. And I think that, I think we'll see shorter careers because of all the Ironman racing that everybody's forced to do two a year. And sometimes they don't get it right. They got to do three. And my feeling is that that's going to be detrimental to the career, long-term careers of the athlete. Now, the nice thing is there's more opportunity. People can make a living at Ironman 70.3, right? When you were the very best in the world at the half Ironman distance, if this was around then, you might not have ever gone to Kona.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's a lot of – the sport's growing in a lot of great ways, and it's evolving, and those of us who love it, it's great to see. But I would agree wholeheartedly. I think I remember winning Kona the first time. For me, the most excitement that I felt personally was knowing that I'd qualified for life. That was the thing. I was laying in bed at night that night after the race, thinking I never have to qualify again. I just couldn't get over it. And, I think one Ironman is plenty, to be honest.
I mean,
whether you're a past champion or not, if you have a great Kona, top 10 or top 15, that should be enough to get you in the following year, in my opinion. And Ironman racing at the highest level is not like racing halves. It takes a toll on your body over time. And as I said, that's coming from the standpoint of a guy who's 42 as well, so maybe there's a little bit of selfishness mixed in with that opinion. But,
you're one of the guys who always wants the fact you didn't just go to Melbourne to validate. You're not going to go to a starting line, and we've talked about this in the past. You could have gone to Challenge Roth a number of years and gotten really good appearance fees. But you didn't do it because your eye was on the prize. Your eye was on Kona. And because of the history, the legacy, the tradition, that's what gets you up in the morning. You know, the money is great, but it's about winning those titles that mean something to Craig Alexander. So if you were able to, if I was running things, it would be once you've won, you could go do Olympic and sprint and show up in Kona. And Craig Alexander could have raced in Kona probably a couple more times.
Yeah, no, mate, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, maybe I would have only got one extra Kona out where I was in the shape I needed to be in, but that would have been great. But no, I agree. I think, you know, when you see athletes who went on those long streaks of great performances in Kona,
that's all they do.
In an era, yeah, they only had to do one Ironman a year, so. Now, if you choose to do more, that's fine too. If some athletes might feel that doing extra helps them for Kona. For me personally, it was, you know, I did feel a little bit cheated when the rule was changed because I thought that was a benefit that I'd worked hard to get, and that was available to anyone who was able to win, good enough and lucky enough to win in Kona would be extended the same courtesy, and then to have that taken away, I did feel a little bit cheated, and I think the rules are slightly changing in the right direction. I now know that if you win a regional championship, you automatically qualify, and I think that's good. I think there should be some encouragement to have the best athletes on the start line in October in their best form, not tired because they've been running around chasing points. You want the big names and every name really, anyone on the start line, male and female across the board. You want them in their best shape at the world championships. I mean, that should be the goal. For the athlete, and that should be the goal from the organizing body. You want the best athletes in their best shape to put on the best show. So, I mean, to that end, I think that's your starting point, and you work from there.
So you mentioned the rivalry with Chris Lieto, that you guys had some great races. Obviously, because you and Macca are from Australia, lumped together because you're from a country. You guys, between you and Macca and Pete, you guys won, what, six titles in a row over in Kona. So when you look at your rivalries over the years, was Lieto one of the better ones? Or you raced Macca more, probably not as many times at the Ironman distance as you did, what, at 70.3 and a halves?
Well, not really. I mean,
or more
Chris,
at Ironman?
Chris and I have only raced twice at 70.3 distance. So
interesting.
That was St. Croix in 07 and Singapore in 09. So... I mean, Macca was certainly one of the guys you had to beat in Kona if you wanted to win. But, yeah, I don't know. I think there was a lot of different rivalries. I mean, when I first went to the U.S. in 2002, the guys you had to beat to win were Craig Walton, Greg Bennett, Simon Lessing.
Yes.
You know, I raced Macca a couple of times then, but his focus was mainly on Ironman by then. So, I mean, I think we raced in L.A. in 2004 and a couple of other places around, but he was wholly and solely focused on
Kona. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, we raced in Minnesota in 2002 as well, but mainly Olympic distance, the guys that I would come up against who, you know, you knew you were in for a tough day were Walton, Bennett, Lessing, Matt Reed.
Yes.
Olivier Marceau was in the US in 2002, former ITU world champ. In half Ironmans, the guys that, you know, I guess I had rivalries with were Lieto, as you mentioned, Michael Raylett at 70.3
yeah.
Worlds, Terenzo Bazzone, Andy Potts, possibly the best 70.3 racer I've ever raced against. I think on his day he's
unbeatable.
Just one of the best at that distance ever.
Yeah.
So, Chris never did 70.3 Worlds, Macca. So yeah, it was more Terenzo, Potts, Lieto, Lessing, Richie Cunningham. So and then later, you know, the last few years, then Seb obviously Keenley came along and won a couple of world titles. Mikey Raylett still there doing well, as is Terenzo. So, I guess I had a few good rivalries with a few different guys. Usually it was different guys at the different distances. But we had a great run in Kona there between myself, Chris, and Pete.
Yes.
And then, you know, you throw in on the women's side, Rinnie and McKeely as well.
Yeah.
I think we had a great 7 or 8 year period there where there was always an Australian on the podium or sometimes more than one of us on the podium. And I think it drove, well, certainly I can only speak for myself, but it motivated me knowing that there are other Aussies there. And, you know, and also the tradition and the history we had with Welshie. And I know when I came to the US the first time, every race I went to, either Greg had won or McKeely had won.
And, exactly, yeah.
You know, as a young Australian, you felt I wouldn't say a pressure. You felt
a little
felt
obligation.
You felt a lot of pride to start with, but also a bit of an obligation to uphold that tradition that we'd sort of forged. You know, it was really started with, I guess, with Greg and McKeely, and also Emma Carney and Brad Bevan had raced in the US a little bit, and Jackie Gallagher. You know, we had a great tradition of winning at races like Chicago and St. Croix.
Alcatraz.
All those races. So, yeah, I certainly know that it motivated me to train very hard because I wanted to be a part of that and uphold that tradition. So, you know, I think there was always a rivalry between the Australians, but I can only speak for myself. It did drive me on I wanted to be a part of that legacy of winning.
Yeah, and you certainly have been. So, Crowe, when you look back, is that 2011 win, is that the most satisfying?
That's a tough question. It's like asking me...
Yeah, what's your favorite kid?
Yeah, do I like Lucy, Austin, or Lani better? And it changes on different days,
If Lucy's hiding behind the tree, probably not.
Yeah, that's right. So usually it's Lani at the moment because she doesn't talk back as much as the other two. But,
that's great.
2011 was a great victory because of what it stood for, changing the way I raced.
Adapting.
And taking a big risk. Yeah. 2008 was a great victory to win there the first time. I mean, 2009 was to defend was...
That was huge.
Possibly the toughest thing I ever had to do. But, you know, I look back at 2005 Minnesota, a race you mentioned right off the top, what it meant financially, but also to me personally, to beat the likes of, you know, Whitfield and Kemper and Hamish Carter and all these Olympic distance specialists, some of the best athletes who have ever raced over that distance. On a day when the biggest prize purse in the history of the sport was up for grabs at, certainly was a life changer and... Yeah, so it's hard to pinpoint, but 11 was special. I mean, it's great to have the record, and that's a great talking point. But all the victories mean something different, and they're all special, to be honest.
Yeah, that's what I liked about it when I went through it. I was like, you know, once you spotlighted Lifetime, it seemed like every year there was a focal point. You know, it obviously became Ironman when you got into 2008, 2009, and beyond. But before that, it was pretty obvious which race was the most important. Crowe, thanks so much for taking so much time and chatting. Love what you bring to the table. You know what I also really like is it seems there was a point there where there weren't as many races in Australia. Australian racing had sort of fallen off. There wasn't really enough enough prize money for people to make a living there. But now it seems like with Melbourne and 70.3s and Ironman Australia, it seems like there's a lot more opportunities for up-and-coming Australian athletes.
Yeah, mate, it's a great point. You know, I'm a massive fan of is this regionalization of the sport and having, you know, Asia-Pacific and European region, and also, obviously, we just had Ironman South Africa, which was the African champs, and we got Brazil this weekend, yes, which is the Latin American champs. I mean, there's world-class racing in every region, and, you know, I can speak for Asia-Pacific. You know, we've seen the emergence of some guys I think are going to go on to win world titles, like Tim Reed, Tim Burkle, the last couple of seasons. You know, Timmy Reed this year, he's
on fire.
Not even just this year. I mean, he won Auckland this year. He's been on the podium in Dubai and in Bahrain, and he got a second in Mandurah, the Aussie champs, last year. And you also see guys like Michael Raylett come down to race. Mikey Raylett was down racing in Australia at the end of the last summer, and I mean, sorry, the start of last summer. So it's bringing world-class athletes down here.
Yes.
And it's giving our athletes a taste of what it's like to race those guys. And I think you can definitely see the level stepping up. You know, another young guy, Sam Appleton, he's on a tear right now. He hasn't lost a race for months and months. And, you know, you're just seeing these young Australian guys and girls stepping up to a world-class level where, you know, they're contenders for major titles. And I think that's what the spread of racing around the world has done. And as you mentioned, I can speak for Australia because, you know, obviously I live down here. And for a long while there, we did have to race in the Northern Hemisphere season to get great world-class competition and great world-class races, but now we have them in our backyard, and I think you're seeing the fruits of that, particularly the last 18 months or 2 years.
Love it. Crowley, thanks again for taking so much time. I give my best to Neri and the kids. You're always a class act. Love, love, love chatting with you.
Hey, mate, thanks for having me on, and I'll go on the record as saying, you know, I will come over to that CAF weekend.
Yes!
I know you guys have a big weekend, the weekend after Kona each year, and it's been tough the last few years, obviously, with the young family, but Neri and I'll get there.
One of these years.
Yeah, you guys are doing amazing work, all the money that you raise, and I'd love to be a part of it 1 year. So
we love to have you. It'd be great, and I think your kids would have a great time, too. You just have to yank them out of school for about a week.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll sign up for that.
Greg Alexander has been our guest. We're brought to you by RacePlace.com, RunCatalina.com, Challenge Athletes Foundation, challengeathletes.org, and you can check out any of our interviews on iTunes or at BabbittVille.com. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.